You're listening to the Wait, What If podcast.
We're about to blow stuff up.
Say we were to walk out in the middle of the woods and find a 50-year-old moonshine bottle.
I think you could drink it.
I think I would drink it.
You know, his mom was probably really controlling and he wet the bed as a kid.
Reminds me of a strip club, actually.
Does it really?
Yeah, this is the champagne.
Ladies and gentlemen, make sure you put the money.
I'm just going to eat this bacon and drink this whiskey.
Be prepared to expand your mind and question your reality. As always, your host, Kevin Sullivan.
We're talking to is Nigel Hetherington. By the way, probably the most British name I think I've ever heard. I guess where we can start is, well, you're a man of two worlds, man of Cairo, Egypt, and Great Britain, correct?
Yeah, and the U.S. I spend at least a couple of months every year in the U.S. as well.
Okay, three worlds. And from, I would try to explain your business model to my listeners, but I'm going to let you do it.
I mean, Past Preservers essentially exists to be the sort of conduit or the hub between the media and the archaeology, heritage worlds, academia as such. So we initially started in Egypt, and we were doing research and development for TV shows and finding experts, and that kind of expanded out from there. So essentially what we do is the media come to us when they're looking for what they call contributing experts, or sometimes referred to as talking heads mm-hmm. on shows.
Okay.
We'll just give an advice and their opinion on different subjects. Or they come to us when they want research and help with a project. And we also provide presenters as well for shows. So the presenters have a slightly different role than the expert. I mean, often presenters are experts as well, particularly obviously the ones we represent. They are full-time academics or scientists, that sort of thing. But they're looking to develop a sort of a longer-term career in the media than, say, one of our experts who may just do, one gig and with the media and never do one again.
Right. What now is your background in archaeology?
Originally, I was an accountant for a long time.
Okay.
I then retrained and as an archaeologist in 2000. And then I ended up specializing in heritage site management. And I did a master's at UCL in London on that subject. And then I moved to Egypt to work for the Theban Mapping Project in Luxor in Egypt, to develop the Valley of the Kings site management master plan. So I was based there for 6 years doing that project with Dr. Kent Weeks. And that's when my sort of connections with the media began to develop.
Right. What made you change from accounting to archaeology? Like, where, that's kind of a big jump.
Boredom, I think, would be the correct phrase. I mean, I got into numbers because I was good with numbers as a child, and I think that's often the way with careers, advice and things and schools. I think I was good, as I said, with numbers, so I chose all those kind of subjects, and I dropped all the humanities and that sort of thing. And I think that kind of education system is wrong, basically. I don't think that children should choose their subjects until they're at least 16. I think everyone should do general education until then. So I was kind of not forced, but certainly encouraged to do a particular career and to take particular subjects that meant that I was quite limited in what I could do when I left school. But you know, some people would say, oh, that's wonderful, you're able to go into accountancy and finance and all those sort of things. But it bored me.
Yeah.
Even though, you know, I was good at it, if I say so myself. I mean, numbers have always fascinated me and everything, but that doesn't necessarily mean that you want to spend your life counting them.
Sure.
So I did 15 years of that in London and at various companies. I was very lucky that I worked for companies that were in the creative side of things. I worked for Time Out. It's a magazine, an arts and media magazine in London. I worked for Avid, the software developer for the media industry. So they do all the special effects and things on films. So I was, you know, in some interesting companies. If you're going to do accountancy, I always say that it's at least do it in a company that's interesting, so you can kind of hang on the coattails of everyone else and get a little bit of fun while you're doing it.
You would have to too, because I tried desk jobs before, and it's just not. I mean, I guess some people can do that, and some people enjoy it, and God bless them for doing that. But you know, you're on this planet for a very short amount of time, and we have bodies and we have brains, but you got to kind of use them both. If you're just using one, I find if I'm just using one thing, you know, like let's say I have to sit at a desk. I work in medicine. So let's say I have to sit at a desk for a day and work on some stuff. By the end of the day, I am antsy. I really need to get out and do stuff.
Yeah.
In the same sense that if I'm out hiking or doing something or riding my bike, for a day, then I need to start using my brain a little bit. I start getting, I don't know, I guess the same thing, mentally antsy.
Well, more that, I mean, that I wasn't stimulated, you know, sort of academically, or my brain wasn't being used. What I was doing was on autopilot. I mean, essentially what I was doing is a sort of modern factory job in a way. It was clerical, but essentially, you know, once you were trained to do it and you had the skills, you could just do it without thinking.
Yeah.
And so when I visited Egypt for the very first time in 1997 on a trip, just on a holiday, a trip down the Nile, and I fell in love with the place, and I'd always wanted to visit Egypt, so it was a bit of a dream come true. And so when I got back to the UK, that's when I decided to do some studying and some further research and read more books on the subject. And I was very lucky that I went to do an evening course at the University College London, their continuing education side of things, which is Birkbeck College. And I had a wonderful tutor, and she really encouraged me to study and to start to write essays and to start and use my brain again. And I did that for over a year. And then when I was made redundant from yet another accountancy job, that's when I decided to go back to university full time.
Is Egypt, I assume it's a completely different place than it was back in the 90s. When was the last time you were there?
Last week.
Oh, really? Is it safe?
Of course, yeah, absolutely. I mean, I don't tot that out just as a sort of, you know, glib thing that the government likes to toot out there, that, you know, everything is safe and everything is wonderful. Of course, it's not.
Right.
Everything is not safe if you're an Egyptian.
Okay.
But everything is perfectly safe if you're a foreigner. And in as much that anywhere can be guaranteed as safe. You know, there have been very little few attacks on tourists in Egypt ever, you know, throughout the revolution. The revolution was about the Egyptian people's fight for justice. It was not about outside forces. Obviously there have been situations where terrorist groups have tried to bring Egypt into that kind of world, but it's failed. Thankfully, and Egypt is really suffering because of the general region rather than what's happening in Egypt itself.
Egypt is on my list of places to go. I've never been. I've read a lot about it. The reason why I ask is because most of my traveling in the Middle East, I was in the military, and even when I was out of uniform, you know, people knew who we were, and I always felt like I had a target on my back. And I'm talking Jordan, trying to think of some other places. Omar, or no, that's this Jordan, Qatar, Doha, you know, and even Africa and places like that. I think we had the military haircuts. We were all in a group. We looked military. And I don't know if the looks that we were getting were just, I don't know. I mean, we stood out. We were obviously the minority in a lot of these places, and maybe it was just curiosity. But you know, when you're in the military, you live under a bit of paranoia, and that paranoia saves you. You know, there's situations where it actually allows you to come home. I haven't traveled since I've been in the military, but I'm wondering if it would feel different, or if I would still feel the same, if I'd be able to shake that.
Well, I think the Egyptian people also understand that, you know, they don't get to choose their government. They don't get to choose the policies of their government and their government's attitude. So they see that, you know, Americans or Brits or whatever it is, you know, they're there in the main as a tourist or someone to work there. So they don't judge you based on the actions of your government.
Okay.
They judge you on your actions and your behavior. And, you know, some foreign people, you know, that go to Egypt do behave a little bit colonially, if that's a word. And, you know, they, you know, the Egyptians obviously pick up on that. But in the main, as I said, they treat you as you treat them. Someone once told me when I first went to Egypt, and I thought it was a very strange thing to say, and I didn't really believe it, that they said, you get back in Egypt what you give. You literally, people are like a mirror. So if you smile at them, they smile back. If you're angry, you will get anger. And it seems really, as I said, like really sort of simple, but actually it seems to be true. The Egyptian people are incredibly, incredibly friendly. And there's a genuine warmth there. That you don't get in many countries. And I went there, as I said, to work on a particular project, but never really left. I feel I have, you know, deep roots there now and have, you know, my Egyptian family as opposed to as my English family and my American family. I think you gather people as you go along in life's, you know, journey.
Sure. So it was 97, you said, was the first time you were in Egypt?
Yeah, that was just, yeah, as I said, that was just a trip down the Nile. It was one of the standard bog cruises that you can do from Luxor down to Aswan. But it was on a ship and things like one of these kind of mass tourism type things that I wouldn't go on and wouldn't recommend now. But even with all that and with the sort of enforced, you know, dressing up as an Egyptian knight and all that sort of thing, and silly competitions and things. Despite all that, it was unbelievable to be sailing down the Nile and looking at these wonderful monuments and visiting these sites. And I think the thing that got me more than anything was the preservation. I couldn't quite get into my head how old these monuments were and how well they looked. Of course, since then, I've become to realize that that's actually a very fragile balancing act. And that is one of the reasons when I went into Egyptology and archaeology that I decided to specialize in site management and cultural heritage studies, because heritage is a finite resource. And places like Egypt, there's a huge amount of pressure. The country, the way it is geographically, you know, only it's a bit of a, you know, often repeated statement, but only 10% of the country is habitable. And you've got 90 million people now. And so there's a huge amount of pressure on the land. And every time someone builds something, it affects on the heritage, on the ancient cities underneath, etc., which we had recently. I don't know if you saw, there was a huge statue discovered in Cairo underneath the modern city and modern district of Heliopolis. So it is a really difficult thing for them to balance the management of heritage. And often by many, it's seen as only an economic asset. And actually, that was one of the things that I was surprised by. I was always told that, you know, that the Egyptians really only viewed it as an economic asset. But that's not true at all either. I think it's also one of the things that we convince ourselves when we're sort of trying to, in a way, appropriate their history for ourselves. You know, Egyptology is a strange thing, a strange world, and lots of dedicated, wonderful people and everything. But it is a strange thing that many, many hundreds of countries, you know, study this particular country.
I think it's an origin type thing, because we know, I mean, we're talking pre-biblical times, and once you get down to, you know, 5,000 years ago, 6,000 years ago, our gene pools start to thin out, you know, and we start to see, you know, I guess a little bit of ourselves, a little bit of our history. And maybe that's why, I don't know, I'm just throwing it out there, that maybe there's a global ownership of these prehistoric sites because of that.
Yeah, you see, I'm quite opposed to that. I'm quite of the view that, you know, I'm not really sure what, you know, World Heritage, I mean, obviously I know what it means and stuff, and it is used quite effectively in some cases to preserve things and protect things, but I think it can be also, can defranchise people from their heritage, and we have to be very careful about that. I think the ownership of Egyptian heritage is Egyptian. It's and I think for many reasons, not just Egyptology, but geopolitically and everything, the Egyptians have been, or people have attempted to divorce them from their past. I mean, one of my professors at UCL, Stephen Quirk, and I think he wrote a paper about this, but you know, what actually is ancient Egypt? I mean, there isn't such a place. You know, there is Egypt.
Right.
There
right.
isn't ancient Egypt.
It's, what's the genetic, I guess I'm trying to think of the question I'm looking for. The modern population there, how genetically close or related are they to, I'll call it the Egyptians of
They are the ancient Egyptians.
Okay.
They are.
Okay.
I mean, obviously, the thing is, every country changes. Every country has immigration, and you know, I mean, where I'm sitting now in Britain, whatever. I mean, these little Britain types that want to, you know, Brexit and the rest of it. They all think that, you know, that they're this pure race that's never been solid since 1066. Well, of course, it's not true at all. You know,
right.
And Egypt had a lot of immigration into the Delta, a lot. A lot of trade with other regions throughout its history, particularly Cairo was Cairo and Alexandria, very cosmopolitan cities. But when you look at the bigger movements, like the Arab invasion, was only a few hundred people. I mean, this is the thing, when the Arab originally came, eventually, obviously, more Arab tribes, etc., moved over, but they settled in particular areas in Egypt as well. And the ancient Egyptians, for want of a better word, didn't leave. They just either became Coptic or they became Muslim over time. But a lot of people will use that to... I mean, there is a strong argument that, you know, Egyptology itself, it's a colonial pursuit. It's not particularly practiced that way by the individuals who do it, but academically, it's a difficult one. And as more and more Egyptians since the revolution, this has been a very positive change. More and more Egyptians have become involved in the management of their past. They've become more vocal about being involved in their past. And changes have taken place that have changed the way the past is studied there, which have been for the good.
There was a minister, and I'm going to, I don't know what his title was, to be honest with you. There was a minister of, we'll just call it antiquities, in Egypt, mm-hmm. where there was a lot of controversy around him. I don't know if he's still the guy that's there.
Yeah, Zahi Was, the man with the hat.
Yes, exactly, yeah.
Yes, we made many, many TV shows with him over the years, and no, he's retired now.
Okay.
He was the director general when it was the Supreme Council of Antiquities, and he later became a minister, and then after that, retired. But he's still active in the region. He's still on various digs and does a few TV shows and things. And he recently became on the board of some UNESCO, an UNESCO appointee. I'm not quite sure what the role is, but a sort of a global heritage kind of role.
What was the controversy that surrounded him?
Oh, I mean, that would take all night to discuss. But I mean, a lot of people didn't like him. Some people, he was a genuine, you know, sort of communicator, a very natural person on camera, and became very, very big, very popular, hugely popular in America, became probably more well-known than the president of the country. I don't think he was particularly popular with the ex-president Mubarak because of that. And he became the face of Egyptology, and a lot of people didn't like that, and a lot of people didn't like his policies. With Zahi, you've got a lot of contradictions. You know, he did a lot of very good things, and that's kind of overshadowed sometimes by some of the controversy. But particularly, I mean, my role doing the site management planning for the Valley of the Kings with Dr. Kent Weeks, you know, we were commissioned by them to do that. It was the first site management plan ever to be done in Egypt. And so we were very grateful to him for commissioning it and saying that it had to be done, and that it was time that these kind of studies were undertaken. And, you know, when he came into office, he banned all excavation south of Giza and only allowed rescue archaeology because he said that anything, you know, south of Giza was safe, you know, unless there was a particular problem with it, and that all the archaeologists' focus should be on the delta, where obviously things were being destroyed on a daily basis by human habitation and by floodwaters and by the rising water table. So, you know, a lot of good practical things he wanted to do, but a lot of people had issues with the way he did things.
Did you ever work with him?
Oh, yes, directly, okay. A lot. We made a lot of TV shows with him over the years. Once we started getting involved in the media world, you know, because he was a big name in that. So obviously most of the documentaries that we worked on in the early days, he was in those documentaries.
Okay. Can you tell me about the Valley of the Kings project, the site management project? I tried to make, and I had read briefly through the PDF that you have on your website. It's a little it's academic, so it's a little beyond my knowledge base.
This was 2003, mm-hmm. and I was doing my master's at that point at UCL at the Institute of Archaeology, and UNESCO were putting forward, and I think it became the rule at that around that time of 2003 and 2004, that all sites on the World Heritage List should have a site management plan. So essentially, you know, the plan is that you evaluate the site, you do a complete survey of its present status. So you look at its history, you look at the current conditions, you assess any danger that faces the site, whether that's, you know, man-made or natural conditions. We carried out a huge visitor survey as well, because we felt that was very important. I mean, a World Heritage site such as the Valley of the Kings, which was attracting at that time, you know, 9,000 people a day, part of what you're trying to manage is the people. And so Dr. Weeks had a visit to Disney, which outraged some colleagues. But the thing is, the top people in people management are Disney. They know how to make people go left without even putting a barrier. They are the sort of the researchers. They are in people management and the psychology of you know, people's behavior when they visit a place and how they behave. And so it was important to understand that, because you can't, in a place like the Valley of the Kings, you do need to control people's behavior. And often you can't police that. You need to do it instinctively and show people that there are things they can and cannot do and how they should behave. So tourism management is a huge part of a site management plan, even for a site that doesn't attract a lot of visitors as well, if you're wanting to attract visitors. So that we did a very large survey with Cairo University. We interviewed tourists and we interviewed the guides, the tour guides that work there. And also, quite more importantly, we interviewed on a one-to-one basis and in small groups, the actual staff of the Valley of the Kings.
So that I never
had not been consulted.
I never really considered it like that. I mean, that makes a lot of sense. That you know, you got to protect the site from the people and from the visitors. And that's really cool that he, well, I wouldn't say cool. I don't know what you would call it, that he went to Disney to do that.
I mean, it's damage limitation, essentially, sure. Because, you know, ultimately, I mean, and when asked about this, I mean, a couple of interviews I did at the time, you know, people got quite upset because I said, you know, and I'm quoted that I think the Valley of the Kings should close. Mm-hmm. And ultimately, they have to. That you cannot; those tombs were not designed for visitation.
Right.
The only way to preserve them for not eternity, but to preserve them for hundreds of years rather than tens of years, is to close them to the public. You know, things like the pyramids actually are a lot tougher. They don't have inscriptions inside. They don't have paintings. They don't have wall relief. You know, something. The pyramids could probably survive, you know, visitation a lot easier than the tombs in the Valley of the Kings. And tombs of the sort of nobles, as they call them, and the elite, which are smaller as well, mm-hmm. they really do suffer badly from visitation. So there is really only one solution.
And it kind of makes sense because I remember reading about the Chauvet Cave in France where they have 32,000 years. That's sealed off.
Yeah, and they started the whole process of replicas. You know, they have. In fact, it was quite funny. The replica cave in Lausanne in Switzerland, as they've just had to close the replica because it's damaged and they're rebuilding it. A part of that process has happened in Luxor. We worked with a company called Factum Arte from Madrid, and they've. They scanned, laser scanned, and made a copy of Tutankhamun's tomb, and that now is built at the entrance to the Valley of the Kings. So there is a replica of a tomb. So it's shown that the technology works, and the replicas can be made, and the experience is very akin to being in the original tomb. Sadly, the original tomb is still open. So it kind of defeats the object of having the replica, but ultimately it probably will close.
I'm going to play devil's advocate here as someone who says, why all the trouble? Why save it? It's ancient, you know, things move on. There's most likely cultures in the world, antiquities in the world that have been lost and we don't know anything about them. Why put all this effort into saving it if no one can actually go there and appreciate it?
I don't think that we can let it go on our watch. I think to accept that we're the ones responsible for its destruction would be shocking.
Right.
As I said, they weren't designed to be open to the public ever. You know, the temples, to a point, you know, the temples underwent restoration constantly during their lifespan as operating temples, and they are public buildings. They're easier to access than a tomb. And they can be maintained to a certain point, the temples. But, you know, Egypt has a huge amount of buildings and sites and monuments to protect. And ultimately, obviously, some of them will actually have to be abandoned. They will fall to pieces. They will, you know, end up being destroyed. That's the nature of life, sadly. We can't save everything. But I think there are some examples, and I think, you know, for something like Tutankhamun's tomb, even though he may not have been a very important pharaoh, he's certainly very important now.
Is there a sense of reverence when you're there? I ask because it seems like time sort of removes any sort of humanity from a site. You know, you go and you visit... as an American, we go and visit George Washington, and you don't feel like you're standing at a tomb. You know, if he had died 5 years ago, I'm sure it would be a solemn area. People would sit and they would pay their respects. But now you go and there's kids, people are taking pictures, and it's not a solemn area. How is it that people treat the Valley of the Kings, and how is it that the locals versus, say, Westerners treat it?
It is a difficult thing. One of the things we did look at in the site management plan is a sense of place and how you create that sense of place. And actually, the controversial Zahi Hawass, one of the things he did, which made a huge difference, he banned the guides from guiding inside the tombs, much as they do in the Sistine Chapel and other places. I think the tomb of the Church of the Holy Sepulchre is the same. There are certain places, I think, that... you know, if you have gangs of, you know, tourists and tour guides shouting on microphones and the rest of it, you've lost all sense of what the place was originally. And so, you know, the tombs in the Valley of the Kings used to be terrible for that. And it really was, you know, like going into a shopping mall. There was no sense of place. And for many people that visited, all, you know, it depends on each individual person as well, what they gain from it. I mean, some people just want to, you know, tick it off and say they've been there. You do see people over the years we spent in the Valley of the Kings, you see very different, you know, sets of people visit. And there are people who do find it an incredibly moving spiritual experience. There are people who come and bring flowers for the dead pharaohs. It totally depends on the person and what they hope to achieve from it. Personally, myself, when I worked there, I found that it, particularly when you're alone in a tomb or something, there is this sense of wonderment, of amazement, of the history, of the length of the tomb, you know, the length of the society existed, etc. It is a very special place, you know. The Egyptians used to call it the place of truth. It is a cemetery, ultimately. And I think we have to try somehow to get that across, but it can be difficult when you're dealing with 9,000 people.
Yeah. And it's we have trouble in today's society appreciating an area or a people that have been around for thousands of years when our culture seems to change on a daily basis. I think the disconnect is getting greater and greater in a shorter amount of time. I mean, our lives are becoming so rapid that how could anyone really understand the nature of a place like the Valley of the Kings? I don't know, maybe I...
Yeah, I mean, it's one of the things I touched on at the beginning of the conversation about Egyptians and how people have, or how people here perceive Egyptians and their connection to the ancient past of Egypt. And, you know, the things that are taken as sort of, as law almost, and stuff, you know, that the Egyptians are not the ancient Egyptians, that old chestnut, that they're not interested in their heritage unless it's for an economic reason. Again, it's rubbish. I'll give you an example. I mean, the cultural continuity, people say, is stronger only in the Copts, in the Christian community. Again, I found that not to be true at all, even though the Copts are passionately proud of their connection because their language was the last sort of vestige of the Pharaonic language. But, for instance, there are two, when you go to Giza to see the Great Pyramid, or the Great Pyramid and the other pyramids that are there, you close to the site, there are two cemeteries, two modern cemeteries, which have recently been walled in to stop their expansion. But they're on the site. They're on the archaeological site, by the edge of the archaeological site, within sight of the Great Pyramid, within sight of the Sphinx. And they're still used by Muslims and Christian Egyptians. And when they die, they want to be buried there. They want to be buried within sight of the pyramid. And a lot of the tombs have little pyramids on top of them.
That's pretty awesome. I can't think of a better place to spend eternity. I'm not Egyptian.
I go there rather than going to the pyramid sometimes.
Oh, really?
And I was told that, you know, when I went there that, you know, why are you going there? It's of, you know, no interest whatsoever. And if you go to other sites like Dahshur and other pyramid sites all along the pyramid sort of complex, you find the same thing. You find small cemeteries attached close to the pyramid site where, and it shows this continuity of culture that people want to be buried to their ancestors. And so it kind of, you know, it very much goes against this perceived notion that people don't have a connection. And also there are spontaneous outbursts of this as well. I mean, a few years ago, they moved the statue of Ramses II from Ramses Square to the site of the new museum they're building. And they didn't tell anyone. It was kind of in the local papers because they were going to move it in the middle of the night because they wanted no traffic. And thousands of people turned out on the streets. dressed up as the pharaohs, some of them. So everybody out with, you know, sort of their picnics and the rest of it, and waving their ancestor by as the statue was moved. So it may not be kind of out there in your face, this connection, but I found that when if you talk to Egyptians and try to understand their connection, it's there.
Now, the next thing I'm going to ask, just because I read and I read and I read, and I can kind of predict how you're going to, I guess, address this topic. But what are your thoughts on individuals like Graham Hancock or Dr. Robert Schock?
Well, I mean, the whole thing with, you know, sort of what people call fringe archaeology and pseudo archaeology. I mean, often, and this is, you know, getting back to what past preservers is about, I mean, often the reason people go to them for the answers that they seek and the knowledge that they seek is because academia isn't inviting to them,
right.
Isn't open to them, isn't able to communicate what they've discovered on their studies in a way that people can understand. And at the same time, these individuals, you know, they also see that there's a gap in the market, and they can, you know, by coming out with sensational claims, can sell a hell of a lot of books and TV shows and things like that. So there's kind of, you know, I think there's problems on both sides of it. Mm-hmm. But occasionally as well, you know, these fringe ideas, they come into the mainstream as well. It wasn't that long ago that sort of, you know, pyramid alignment to the stars and pyramid alignment to Heliopolis and other temples was considered fringe, and then that's considered mainstream now.
Who was it that came up with that? I can't remember his
quite
name.
Quite a few different people on the fringe, and also Egyptologists as well. Mm-hmm. But also... There are countless other examples. I mean, there was a gentleman from the UK, not an Egyptologist, archaeologist, anything, and he claimed to have discovered caves under Giza, and natural caves, not man-made. Mm-hmm. And everyone thought he was a complete fool, and he brought out this book called The Caves of Giza, and he claimed to have been in them and gone into a tomb and gone through this tomb and discovered these caves, and there were pictures of him in a cave. And the whole kind of establishment said it was rubbish. And then, but no one investigated. Mm-hmm. No one went to check. And then actually when we were shooting a show called Chasing Mummies with Zahi Awas, the producers wanted to know if these caves existed. So we went down into the back of this tomb, climbed through a hole in the wall, and hey presto, we were in a lot of caves. So they're real and they exist. And... you know, the pharaohs actually worked them because there are steps in there. Some of the caves have been opened up. The workers took place on them. They're natural. They're formed naturally. Mm-hmm. They don't go under the pyramid. They don't appear to go anywhere near the pyramid. They actually go away from the pyramid. But it may have been the reason the site was chosen, because it could have been considered the burial place of Osiris or something underneath the pyramid. So... you know, the thing is, you have to investigate these claims.
So they serve their purpose, I guess, would be the answer.
Exactly.
They serve their purpose. But, and I think one of the biggest things, as a scientist, or I consider myself a scientist, you know, if it lacks the scientific method, then you always have to say, you know, you have to approach it with some skepticism. Well, I mean, you even have to approach science with skepticism.
Well, I remember years ago going to a conference and they were talking about, you know, why pyramids were built in particular places by particular pharaohs. And, you know, what was the reasoning, the deep philosophical reasoning behind your pyramid here and your son's pyramid somewhere else and this sort of thing. And it was an engineer, I believe, who came up with the solution, but it hasn't been accepted by everybody, but he came up with a solution that essentially that because the pyramid sites themselves were huge construction areas, mm-hmm. which would have created, you know, entire villages, we know they had villages and everything to support them, that once the pyramid was complete, that the project management of removing this mess and this waste and these buildings and everything would take years. So the thing was that there was no way that then the son of the pharaoh could then go ahead and build his pyramid next door to daddy. He would have to find somewhere actually a little bit further away,
right,
or completely further away. So maybe it wasn't a religious reason. Maybe it wasn't a deep reason. Maybe, you know, there was just a, actually, it was just practical.
Yeah.
And sometimes we can't see the wood for the trees for looking for the answers.
Sure. And I guess you need creativity in looking at your answers. I mean, there's a lot of gap there. Wow, that's fascinating. Well, where can people, you know, learn about your, well, I guess you, they can go to your website, but is your book published?
Yeah, it is. It was published by the American University Press in Cairo, and it is available outside of Egypt as well. I think it was done with Thames and Hudson in the US. It's a little bit out of date now. It's a few years ago, but the sort of core principles obviously remain the same of site management. And obviously, if they go onto our website as well, you can on pastpreservers.com, you can, you know, see what we're trying to do. I mean, essentially now, you know, the majority of the work we do is for the media. We, as I said, we try to find people for projects for the media. We do what's called, you know, casting services, which are essentially, you know, putting expert A onto, you know, onto program B and in the correct, in location C. We work closely with producers and networks to develop shows. We have a show at the moment currently in development that we have all our own experts on, and we're working with them on the story, which, you know, is incredibly exciting to be able to do that from scratch. And we're always looking for new experts for our database. And we're looking for people who are interested in a career in the media as well. So we're always looking for the presenters of tomorrow. There's a huge demand for people who want to move into that world. And it's a difficult thing, presenting. It requires a certain amount of set of skills that not a lot of people have. And so we're always looking for those people who have that. I think it can be learned, but I think in the main, it comes naturally to someone.
Last question, and this is just because I've read of all Graham Hancock's book, and I read the whole thing about Robert Schoch and how he saw the water erosion, or the alleged water erosion on the Sphinx. How old do you think it is?
Well, the rocks, as you know, as old as it is, it's a rock.
Right.
You know, it's not a statue. I mean, this is the thing that people seem to get very confused about. It's bedrock.
Right.
It's cut. So there's no way to age it.
Hmm.
It's impossible.
So it's more of a romantic idea that, you know, this was something that was put up longer than 6,000 years ago, longer than 10,000 years ago.
Well, I wouldn't say it was romantic. I'd say it's insane.
Okay.
You know, I mean, the thing is, we don't know what the site was used for before. It was obviously used as the main necropolis of the Old Kingdom. We don't know ultimately why they chose that particular site and why they, you know, did that. But obviously, the outcrop of rock that they used may even have given them the idea. It may have even looked like the Sphinx due to natural weathering or something. Wow. And so they then... We know that they did intervene with natural features because, mm-hmm. for instance, in the Valley of the Kings above it is the mountain Lacerne above the Valley of the Kings. Now, the mountain these days doesn't look much like a pyramid. It does from a distance, but we know that during the New Kingdom that what they actually worked it, they shaped it to look more like a pyramid.
Oh, yeah. I'm looking at a picture of it now.
Yeah, you know, yeah, I mean, it does look like a pyramid, sure, from a distance. And there is graffiti on it and inscriptions and around the base. And so the thing was that when people say the Egyptians abandoned pyramid burials, they didn't, because essentially the Valley of the Kings is under the pyramid.
Wow.
But they just didn't go and build them.
Well,
it was too much trouble to build them.
Well, what's the fun in that? We want aliens and we want magical people that lived well before we.
Well, the thing is, as I always say, the Egyptians were magical people. I mean, and they are magical people. It is one of the most amazing countries in the world. It still is one of the, you know, sort of, you know, bucket list of almost everybody. You know, every one of the wonderful thing about my job and working there and everything is that, you know, you're constantly being asked by my family's kids and stuff, you know, about Egypt, and they want you to go to their school and talk about everything. Every generation is fascinated by
sure
Egypt.
Is.
I think they always will be.
That was a great answer. It shut me up.
I mean, sometimes, you know, we all get, you know, to the point where sometimes you get a little bit bored with your job and everything. And then suddenly I'll be sitting, you know, the other week I was on a boat going across the Nile to go to Luxor. Flipping a new training center, the Fatemate is built there for 3D scanning. And I thought, you know, life isn't so bad.
Yeah, that's pretty cool. Well, hey, thank you, Nigel Hetherington. Did I say your last name right?
You did, perfectly.
All right, fantastic. And what's your Twitter handle?
It's at Past Preservers. Everything is Past Preservers, basically. So, yeah, you should be able to find me on that. And if not, go to our website, pastpreservers.com, and there are links from there as well.
All right, fantastic. Well, I am forever grateful for your time, and it's late there, so get some sleep.
Yeah, it definitely is. It's coming up to 12 o'clock, I think, or something. So anyway, lovely to talk to you, Kevin, and thank you very much.
All right, you're welcome. Take care.
Like us on facebook.com/WWIPodcast. And at WWI Podcast on Twitter. Drop us a line at waitswhatifpodcast@yahoo.com. Listen to us on iTunes, Stitcher, or TuneIn Internet Radio. Enjoyed your listening experience. Now go forth and expand your reality.